Hi, I'm Rob Nadelson, and this is part two to your guide to this year's constitutional cases from the Supreme Court. This is a second in a two-part series that thumbnails the 10 most important constitutional cases in the Supreme Court's October 2022 term, which ended on June 30, 2023. These essays relate the gist of each case and whether it was based on constitutional, originalist grounds, or on other factors. They show that the court, far from being controlled by a widely proclaimed conservative majority, is in fact highly fractured. Moreover, it's ready and able to strike down state laws, but seems unwilling to challenge overreaching by Congress. The first installment covered three cases, Tyler versus Hennepin County, 303 Creative versus Alanis, and Holland versus Brackeen. This second installment examines the remaining seven. First, Sackett versus Environmental Protection Agency. This case interpreted a statute, the Clean Water Act, but it also had major constitutional implications. The result in the case has been labeled a conservative victory because the justices unanimously cut back the Environmental Protection Agency's jurisdiction over wetlands. However, the justices divided 5-4 on how much to cut it back. Justice Clarence Thomas wrote an opinion pointing out that the Constitution grants Congress power merely over navigable waters rather than wetlands per se. It's part of Congress's power to regulate foreign and interstate commerce. But only Justice Neil Gorsuch agreed with Justice Thomas. So the result is more accurately characterized as a centrist victory rather than as a conservative or originalist one. Next case, Health and Hospital Corporation of Marion County versus Tlaibski. In addition to its pretensions under the Constitution's Commerce Clause, Congress also claims unlimited spending power under the Taxation Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. Congress regulates even beyond the scope of its Commerce Clause power by purportedly using the Taxation Clause to grant money to states, local governments, and private institutions, and then imposing conditions on the grants that it gives. In the Tlaibski case, a county-owned nursing home, since it was county-owned, that means that the nursing home was a subdivision of the state for legal purposes, a county-owned nursing home had accepted federal funds and the long list of conditions that go with it. The issue was whether federally imposed conditions are merely contract terms or whether they're enforceable as laws. In a victory for the court's liberals, a 7-2 majority said they're laws. Justice Thomas wrote alone to point out that the Taxation Clause actually doesn't give Congress unlimited spending power. Moreover, even if it did grant unlimited spending power, treating the conditions as laws violates a long-standing rule that Congress can't order state and local governments, including their nursing homes, to adopt laws. Next case is United States versus Texas. We'll treat that very briefly. This was an attempt by the states of Texas and Louisiana to force President Joe Biden to carry out his constitutional duty laid out in Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution, his duty to enforce federal immigration law. In an 8-1 liberal victory, the sole dissenter was Justice Samuel Alito. The court held that the states didn't have standing to sue. Next decision is Counterman versus Colorado. A hallmark of the liberal Supreme Court majorities of the 20th century was their propensity to make up free speech law as they went along. Essentially, it was a form of judicial legislation. The 20th century liberal majorities almost never consulted history to learn what the First Amendment meant when it was adopted. Although this court is no longer characterized as a liberal one, the decision in Counterman versus Colorado continues this liberal pattern. What are called true threats aren't protected as free speech. And the issue in the Counterman dispute was the definition of a true threat. Justice Elena Kagan's opinion for the majority reached a reasonable result, but the opinion did so by guesswork and by applying a limited number of case precedents. Her opinion devoted little attention to what the First Amendment really means by free speech. Another liberal victory. Only Justices Thomas and Amy Coney Barrett dissented. Moore versus Harper. The Constitution grants state legislatures power to draw the lines for congressional districts. That's in Article 1, Section 4, Clause 1. It's a clause the court calls the Elections Clause, but is probably better called the Times, Places, and Manner Clause. The issue in Moore versus Harper was this. When this section of the Constitution refers to a state legislature having power to draw the lines for congressional districts, does this mean the legislative assembly acting alone, as in the constitutional amendment process? Or does the term state legislature mean the state's entire legislative apparatus, including signature by the governor and review by the state courts? A 6-3 majority decided that state legislature means the state's entire legislative apparatus. This case is generally considered a liberal victory. Chief Justice Roberts, who dissented on the conservative side in a similar case 8 years ago, flipped to the liberal side in this one. So the liberals won back-to-back victories on this issue. Actually, the question was a close one. I tend to believe the court's answer, that is, that the term state legislature referred in this part of the Constitution to the entire legislative apparatus of the state, including review by the courts, I tend to believe that the Supreme Court's answer was correct. However, Roberts' opinion for the court contains some overreaching language that may cause trouble in presidential election cases later. Specifically, he implies, contrary to precedent, that a state legislature's decision on how to choose presidential electors is subject to state court review. I think this is rather clearly wrong, and it could cause delay, confusion, and injustice in resolving future contested presidential elections. For an article analyzing Moore versus Harper in greater detail, check on the Independence Institute website. It'll be there shortly after this article appears. Finally, we come to the two affirmative action cases. These were, first, Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard University, and second, Students for Fair Admission, same plaintiff, Students for Fair Admission versus the University of North Carolina. The same plaintiff brought the first lawsuit against a private institution, Harvard, and the second lawsuit against a state institution, the University of North Carolina. Both suits challenged widespread university admissions practices. Specifically, many colleges and universities discriminate against East Asian applicants and Caucasian applicants, especially Caucasians who aren't from elite families. The universities correspondingly favor certain other demographic groups, notably African Americans, Hispanics, and American Indians, and a few others. The universities claimed their discrimination was necessary to obtain the, quote, educational benefits from diversity. But as I have detailed in a previous essay on the Independence Institute website, this claim that the university is just trying to seek the educational benefits from diversity, this claim is demonstrably false. A 6-3 majority of the court agreed and ruled against the universities. Discrimination based on race and ethnicity is unconstitutional and also illegal. It's also my view, and here Chief Justice Roberts' opinion seemed to implicitly agree, that a driving force behind the discrimination was political. The favored groups, those groups that are given special treatment by the universities, are all key demographic constituencies in the National Democratic Party. The disfavored groups include non-elite whites who tend to be more conservative. And I would add this would include non-elite white groups that have been historically discriminated against, as well as Asians who have traditionally been discriminated against. The ruling against the University of North Carolina was that its practices violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. In my view, this result was correct. As Justice Gorsuch noted, the ruling against Harvard should have been under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But for reasons Chief Justice Roberts really didn't explain, the justices based their judgment against Harvard on the Equal Protection Clause as well. Since the Equal Protection Clause applies only to state institutions and Harvard is private, this appears to be an error. But it probably is what we lawyers call harmless error. The Supreme Court's decisions this term confirm a pattern set earlier. This is no longer the liberal activist bench it was throughout much of the 20th century. It is rather a fractured bench, with results that can go in any direction, except one. This court, unlike the one led by Chief Justice William Rehnquist from 1986 to 2005, is unwilling to challenge overreaching by Congress. I'm Rob Nadelson, and thanks for listening.